One game away from the state Division IV title game. They're in the semifinals tonight. They play Marathon up in Green Bay. Tip-off is 8:45. A number of ways you can hear that game. It'll be carried live right here on WGTD. It'll also be online at WGTD.org or on your smartphone once you download the free WGTD app. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Thursday, 10th of March. Cloudy and pleasant, a high of 53 inland, cooler near Lake Michigan. Right now, wind from the northwest at 5. It is overcast. 43, we're seeing in Kenosha. 42 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 11 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Easter candy, and don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com.
I am very excited whenever the topic of the U.S. presidency take center stage on the morning show, as it does today, as I take in hand a very interesting book called The Leading Man, Hollywood and the Presidential Image. The book is written by Burton Peretti, a professor of history at Western Connecticut State University. And in this book, Professor Peretti has taken aim at the U.S. presidency through a most intriguing lens, offering up some interesting observations on how the world of Hollywood and the world of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue have intersected and worked together in some very intriguing ways, sometimes in ways far beyond or beneath the obvious. His book also takes a long view, that is, long before there was anything like motion pictures or a motion picture industry. Professor Peretti takes the time to examine some ways in which the public role of the U.S. president changed and, in a sense, became highly symbolic and in some ways almost cinematic even before such a term even existed. But in particular, he examines experiences of some of our more recent presidents who, of course, come to prominence during the heyday of Hollywood and the ways in which those worlds have affected one another. Again, the book is called The Leading Man, Hollywood and the Presidential Image. And Professor Burton Peretti, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
I should mention to our listeners, although by the time we talk, I hope Hurricane Sandy will be no longer making headlines. But this morning, as we are recording this interview, you tell me you are essentially battening down the hatches at your home, not at school, classes canceled as you await the pummeling, which Sandy promises. How are things where you are right now?
Oh, not too bad. Windy, but so far so good, I think.
So tell us where you got the idea of examining the U.S. presidency in this particular way, in the light of the influences of Hollywood. Did anything in particular prompt you to explore this?
Well, it did. An earlier project of mine was about nightclubs in Manhattan in the 1920s and 30s when they were a new institution. And I wrote a lot about the political controversy that nightclubs caused as being a kind of risque new entertainment that often featured illegal whiskey during Prohibition times. And I was fascinated by the figure of Mayor Jimmy Walker of New York, who was someone who led a crusade against nightclubs, but at the same time, this was a man who went to nightclubs, a man who really began as a songwriter on Broadway, or on Tin Pan Alley, I should say, writing popular songs, writing lyrics, and really living in that Broadway milieu. And I thought it was interesting that you have a politician, you know, a very important mayor, having one foot in the entertainment world like that. And I also wrote about how nightclubs seem to bring entertainment into the political sphere. People started arguing about what this new mass culture, this entertainment meant, and how it should be regulated. And from there, it was a fairly easy step to other politicians, particularly presidents, and how they might interact with other mass entertainment. And Hollywood seemed like the obvious subject to take up, and the presidency, obviously the obvious group of politicians to examine with respect to Hollywood. And, of course, we all know, I think, about connections that exist, such as Ronald Reagan and his career and so on. So I felt that I had a lot to work with, and I just kept working at it and finding new things, and it was certainly a fascinating project.
Absolutely. Well, we wouldn't be holding an interesting book in our hands were it not a really good topic, a promising topic that you've explored very, very thoroughly. I think one of the things that came as a pleasant surprise to me is the fact that you do take a long view of this, and your examination does not begin with the dawn of the film industry, but you try to really set that moment in context by really taking us all the way back to the first president, George Washington. At a glance, it would seem to make no sense, given the title of your book and its primary focus. Tell us why this long view dating all the way back to our very first presidents was important to you.
Yeah. Well, I suppose historians will always say that everything takes place in a context, and it just doesn't start on day one, and everything is brand new, and people don't make any connections with things that had happened before. But if you think about the words and some of the concepts we attach to Hollywood, celebrity, fame, stardom, charisma, all of these are concepts that existed well before the first motion picture was ever shot. And it's only really fair to take a look at how those things existed in American society, especially around the American presidency, before there were movies. In other words, what were people primed to think when the movies arrived on the scene? Just to give you one example, certainly leaders had been seeking fame not just since George Washington, but for millennia, shaping how they appeared in public, how they moved, how they spoke, how they dressed, to, of course, maintain their following or increase their following. Kings, dictators, military leaders did that. Charisma, of course, is actually a religious term going back to ancient Greece. It means gift from God. Celebrity, the modern concept of celebrity, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, arrives around the 1830s. And, of course, it's connected to the print media. And then stardom, people in the 1860s and 1870s were already talking about theater actors as stars, and the star system really originates on the stage. So all of that is sort of in place when Hollywood arrives. Hmm. And certainly I do talk about them, the presidents, and how they react to some of these forces of celebrity and stardom and so on, and how it interacts with politics. George Washington certainly presents himself in a very regal fashion to suggest unity and solidity, because the new republic is young and fragile. He is the first president through his magnificent carriage, his very handsome clothing, his powdered wig, his rather stiff formal stuffy parties that he held, official levees every Friday afternoon. He tried to convey this image of solidity and permanence in the presidency, which certainly looked aristocratic to many people.
Right. And of course, you tell us that for all that Washington did to sort of carefully craft the office and to make it something it was not, I mean, he did not want to be seen as the new king of America. I mean, he wanted to be seen as the duly elected president and nothing more, and yet needed to be a figure that helped unify this the struggling new nation, but that already the second president, John Adams, is in a sense unable to fully step into the shoes, the imposing shoes of his predecessor. I mean, this yeah. becomes complicated right off the bat.
Right, absolutely, and it really relates to the office of the president itself, which is not designed to be a charismatic or regal figure. And there's a strong sentiment in America that the president is, as you say, an official, really, somebody sitting behind a desk, and largely a passive official, too, who either signs or vetoes the bills he gets from Congress, otherwise maybe receives foreign dignitaries, and oversees the Postal Service and the Army, such as it was at that time. And there's this very strong Republican concept, small r Republican concept of the president as a citizen who is simply marking time in office and doing a very limited set of duties. And that very much fights against any idea that the president is a star. And Thomas Jefferson, for example, very much emphasized the plainness of his presence in the executive mansion. It wasn't called the White House yet. And he had a very plain sort of existence there in this huge house. Hmm. And that continued throughout the 19th century, really.
Hmm. One thing I like about this opening chapter is by no means are you guilty of oversimplification. I mean, there's no painting with the broad brush here. And we're shown yeah. kind of the eddies and the ebb and flow of sort of the public image of the presidency and the way that it functioned, depending on if times were good or if times were bad, as we lead into the turbulence of the Civil War and its aftermath and so on. The presidency is this shifting thing, although very different from what we think of as the U.S. president now. And some of the figures who figure prominently in some of those shifts will probably be a surprise to your readers. For instance, a woman by the name of Julia Gardner Tyler.
Right.
Do you want to say just a quick word about the role she plays in this interesting story?
Sure, sure. She was a first lady. She was actually the second wife of President John Tyler. They actually married while he was president. In fact, they eloped in New York City. They married somewhat secretly. She was, I believe, only about 23 years old when they married, and he was in his 50s. But Julia Tyler, once she was ensconced in Washington as the president's wife, was quite a regal figure. She preferred to be addressed as Lovely Lady Presidentress, and she had a rather fancy carriage drawn by Arabian horses. And she also had really a publicity agent, a journalist who put out very favorable stories about her to be printed in the newspapers. And what that indicates best, I think, is the celebrity of the First Lady, which in some ways anticipates the popular celebrity of the presidents in the 20th century. First ladies had no official capacity. There were women, of course, who were not even voting, really, in the 19th century. So they're famous for their fashion. They're famous for their social skills, who they know, what parties they throw, and so on, but also famous for their looks and perhaps their behavior in public, all of the things that we associate with modern celebrity and with film stars, I guess. So the First Lady, in some ways, sets the mold, which the presidents start falling into as well. As the print media grow, as news becomes more interested in features, with magazines and so on coming in the late 19th century, as well as Sunday supplements and newspapers, presidents become part of the social scene. And the First Ladies, in some ways, are the pathfinders for that.
Hmm. The other interesting story in this first chapter, which is very much in line with, of course, the balance of your book, is the emergence of a very vibrant theatrical scene in the United States, from, of course, rather paltry beginnings, as we might well imagine, to something which is culturally very much center stage. What is most important for us to remember about theatrical life in the 19th century in America?
Well, with respect to our topic, I think it's worth noting that it becomes a big commercial success. I mean, it's a big industry by the mid-19th century. And also, it feeds directly into this new culture of celebrity. Newspapers are promoting personalities, are promoting individuals who in some cases become famous for being famous. And what happens, starting in the 1830s, really, is that theater leading actors start showing up at the president's mansion and paying a call on the president. And the president, who, again, is largely a passive figure, probably has some time on his hands, welcomes this individual, and in the eyes of the public, it's two celebrities meeting each other. And this becomes increasingly frequent, actors visiting, and one thing it does is weaken the old Puritan objections to the theater. There had been objections by the clergy that the theater was immoral, that it depicted false things on stage, and that also actors traditionally were a very dissolute group who traveled around and had no roots and no normal family life. Well, increasingly, the actor becomes much more respectable in the 19th century. A key figure here is Edwin Booth, who's one of the leading actors of the stage. He campaigns later in his life to make actors a respectable profession, and he hobnobs with a few presidents like Grover Cleveland. Of course, there's a ton of irony in there, since Edwin's brother, John Wilkes Booth, had assassinated Abraham Lincoln. There are many ironies involving the Booth family and the presidency, which I can't get into. But generally, what you see is a rise in the popularity of the theater and in its social prestige. And soon, presidents are regularly socializing with leading theatrical actors. And that sets the stage for the 20th century social interaction between presidents and film stars.
I wonder if you could just say a quick word about a very interesting observation you make. This harkens back to something you said earlier, that really the framers of the Constitution, as much as anything, envisioned the president as sitting behind a desk administering. And there is really nothing on paper that sort of suggests that the president is supposed to be anything really more than that. You mentioned this in the wake of certain 19th century presidents who seemed taken with the theatrical style of great actors, yeah, and perhaps made an attempt here and there to emulate them in their own oratory. And of course, now we can't even separate the U.S. president from giving thundering inspirational speeches, or yeah, at least hoping to, intending
right,
to.
Right.
But of course, you're talking about a day when such a notion is still very much in its infancy.
Right. Well, presidents didn't just sit in their house. They did go on tour. In fact, some presidents launched very elaborate national tours to sort of see what was going on in the country. And they would be received by tens of thousands of people. So that did happen, although generally presidents did not give big speeches in front of big crowds, usually. You know, very few people saw the president in any given administration. But, again, it's sort of the complexity of the picture. You have some personalities who are very outsized. Andrew Jackson, who very much harkens back to the tradition of the charismatic military leader who imposes his will on the office. And Jackson wasn't particularly interested in celebrity or in getting into the newspapers, but he sort of set the mold in some ways of someone whose personality defines the office. Abraham Lincoln was another strong personality in the office, and he, of course, was very fascinated by the theater and also fascinated by the art of speechmaking, of course. He placed a lot of emphasis on his oratory as a leader. One interesting trend that happens is the rise of what's generally called realism in American culture in the late 1800s. It's in literature, painting, and so on. In other words, seeing things like it was and not being too flowery in your expression, of being straightforward. And this has an effect on presidential oratory, most markedly with Theodore Roosevelt, who is famous for his dynamism and his exuberance, But actually, he was quite a measured speaker. His oratory was rather matter of fact, and it struck a chord with Americans who saw that he was not putting on any phony theatrics in his oratory. And, of course, that kind of realism will be very important in the movies later on. The actors who were the most natural, especially in the talkie era, were the ones who were successful, the ones who seemed not to be putting on airs or being orotund in their expression.
We're speaking with Burton Peretti about his book, The Leading Man, Hollywood and the Presidential Image. And, of course, Theodore Roosevelt is a revolutionary figure in several different ways. Yeah. And he comes to the presidency, of course, upon the assassination of William McKinley, and in a sense seems to signal the beginning of so many new things. And he he's, of course, if not exactly the first president to be filmed, certainly the first one to be extensively filmed. But you also tell us that he comes to the presidency at a time when what you call the new energy of the urban masses is expressing itself in many genres of popular entertainment. Things like vaudeville, ragtime, and, of course, the Nickelodeon, which is right at the dawn of the film industry. So how does this shape Theodore Roosevelt, or how does Theodore Roosevelt affect this new entertainment?
Yeah. Well, Roosevelt's fascinating at a lot of levels. One of them, though, is that he certainly was his own PR man. I mentioned how in his 20s, very early age, when he's working as a cowboy in Dakota Territory, he reenacts an incident where he and some of his ranch hands captured a couple of thieves who had stolen, I think, a boat from their ranch. And he has a photographer take pictures of himself, Theodore Roosevelt, standing guard with a rifle over the two thieves who were played by the ranch hands. And he sent those photographs back east for the New York newspapers. Roosevelt had spent some time in the state legislature in New York, and here he is, you know, kind of producing publicity for his next political run. And he's like that. He's very conscious of the newspapers, very conscious of playing to the mass media. So he's very much in that mode of using the urban mass culture to advance his presidency, and he certainly embraces some issues that he think will be popular and will maintain his prominence in the newspapers. Roosevelt is not terribly sympathetic with the immigrant working classes in the city. He is, of course, an old money, old stock American, living on Long Island, really, not in New York City. But he is certainly in that era, which gives birth, as you say, to the movies. All of those things like vaudeville and the concert saloons of the cities paved the way for the Nickelodeon then. It's Thomas Edison's invention, but it is adapted then to these huge audiences in the cities. And the Nickelodeons are those early little theaters that start popping up around 1903, 1904. And they're the predecessors, of course, of the big movie palaces of the 1910s and the Hollywood studios that appear in the same time.
I was surprised that there was so much interesting stuff to be said about one of our most maligned and frankly, most forgotten presidents, Warren G. Harding. But you tell us about how, of course, Harding, who is ascends to the presidency right after Woodrow Wilson, right after, of course, the First World War has finished, was actually engaged in tireless sort of PR campaigns, and as, in a sense, is his successor, Calvin Coolidge, a very, very different figure. I think it's really interesting because it underscores the fact that this happens in different ways with different presidents, and yet it's all part of kind of the same fascinating, sweeping story.
Yeah. Well, Harding was really managed by a campaign manager, a guru, Harry Doherty, who built up his image for 20 years and essentially sold him into the White House. It wasn't the first PR campaign for a president. presidential candidate, but it certainly was one of the most effective and one of the most imitated. So Harding himself did not do that much. He did welcome Mary Pickford to the White House, probably the first president to make a big show of welcoming a film star to the White House, as it was now known. But yes, Calvin Coolidge, who becomes president after Harding's death, really actively enhances his image. He had a lot of fun with portraying himself as a taciturn Vermonter, but he was quite adept at scheduling photo shoots and finding good photo opportunities, I guess we'd call them, some of them rather amusing, some of them at his own expense. And he also had a speechwriter. Harding had actually hired the first White House speechwriter, and Coolidge continued to use him. So those innovations. And also Coolidge was the first president to speak on radio at all, but he also made a number of nationwide addresses, and his voice was very well suited for radio. So he knew that, and he exploited it. In some ways was a predecessor to other presidents who exploited mass media.
Tell us about what happened at the White House on October 17th, 1924, because this is sort of a noteworthy occasion. Probably this same sort of thing had happened any number of times, but maybe not before on quite this exciting scale.
Yes. Well, that was... there was a breakfast at the White House involving dozens of performers from Broadway, some of them very notable actors of the time, such as John Drew, Ethel Barrymore, I think, Al Jolson, comedy performers, musical performers, and serious dramatic performers came to the White House. They took a train down from Broadway, from New York, I think overnight, arrived for breakfast at the White House. And Calvin Coolidge sat down, and Mrs. Coolidge as well, and they had breakfast and took a lot of photographs. It was a complete non-event. It had no importance. It was purely for the cameras. It was, of course, a few weeks before the presidential election, which Coolidge was participating in. It was a show of support from Broadway figures. But I think what's most important about it was that it was purely a concoction of a public relations individual, in this case, Edward Bernays, who's a fascinating figure. He was the self-styled father of public relations, an Austrian immigrant, the nephew of Sigmund Freud. Edward Bernays took credit for a lot of things, for popularizing bacon and eggs, for instance. But he also, in some ways, pioneered the modern photo opportunity for presidents. And this occurred with the Coolidge breakfast in 1924. A little later, Herbert Hoover appeared at, I think it was a Thomas Edison birthday celebration in Dearborn, Michigan, which Bernays very carefully choreographed. So these sorts of things became pretty commonplace starting in the 1920s, and Bernays could be called a pioneer presidential bar.
I like how you describe this Bernays's event, actually a non-event or a publicity stunt, turned the White House into a set for a carefully staged tableau. And,
right.
And you know, now we so take that for granted, but it's probably really important for us to think about that, because such a thing would have been unthinkable in the days of George Washington. Of course, there's no such thing as photography, of course, back then. But even so, even if photography had existed, it's a little bit difficult to think about such a thing occurring in the earliest days of our country. We just didn't think of the White House as the backdrop for a photo op in the way that was evident on this occasion, and of course, really ever since.
Well, the dark side to that is that by the 1920s, especially after World War I, which had seen so much propaganda on both sides, but particularly in America, that experience, it turned some thinkers very cynical about the public. And the concept of public opinion actually originates in the 20s. And the dark conclusion is that the public could be manipulated if one was creative with public relations and staged things well. One could make the public think whatever he wanted to make the public think. So there was some concern, in other words, that these techniques could shape public opinion and replace whatever individual thinking was going on. And so that would be a very pessimistic view of what was happening beginning in the 20s. But other people, of course, thought that public relations was wonderful. It was a way to enhance the president's popularity and perhaps the president's agenda, and perhaps simply make people feel a little better about the man in the White House. So all of those currents really start churning in the 20s especially.
We're speaking with Professor Burton Peretti about his book, The Leading Man, Hollywood and the Presidential Image. When you tell us about the golden age of the Hollywood studios and this heyday during the presidencies of Herbert Hoover and Franklin D. Roosevelt, you mentioned something that is really quite interesting, and it's one of those things I think a lot of us maybe know or would sort of realize if we stopped and thought about it, and that is that as films became such a prominent part of our culture, the earliest films, the great silent films and into the early talking films, all subscribed for the most part to a very strict sort of code or script, that we did not see any of the, or very little of, kind of the wide-ranging, freewheeling, courageous creativity that we saw in other art forms, that compared to those, filmmaking in this era was really rather strictly, constricted. And I wonder if you could just expand on that and maybe say a word about why it's important to know that in thinking about this larger story involving the presidency.
Right. Well, I think you're talking about plot formulas and sort of, standard ways of shooting a movie, that sort of thing. Yeah. I mean, certainly there were experimental filmmakers on the fringes doing very interesting things with the camera. And, you know, later on you'd have people like Orson Welles, you know, really revolutionizing how movies could be made through various techniques. But really by the 1920s, in the silent era, filmmakers, first of all, it was a business, and films were expensive to make. Yeah, it's cheap to write a novel, experimental or formulaic, but to make a movie cost, even in those days, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you had to be assured of some return to cover your expenses. And so that meant that you had to, in some ways, give the public what it already knew, what it expected. There was a good deal of audience research already taking place in the 1920s to figure out what sort of stories people wanted to see, what they reacted to well in certain stories, and what they didn't react to. And all of this creates a set of kind of cliches, I guess we'd call them, in terms of how characters are drawn, in terms of how the plots are constructed. And movies create this very simplified version of real life. And then another overlay we have to talk about is the production code, which is coming from clergy, particularly the Catholic Church, who become quite worried at depictions of sex and violence and antisocial behavior in movies. And the production code keeps getting stricter until the kind of classic code is put in place, I think, in 1933, and the Motion Picture Association of America, which had a different name then, is put in place to enforce the code. And so, you know, there are all these restrictions on what could be shown. Every murderer in the movies has to be punished. Every adulterer has to be punished. You can't show the female navel in a motion picture. All these sorts of things get added. So the movies become a formulaic mass medium. And the effect on the presidency is a little indirect, but certainly it indicates that in the mid-20th century, mass media and celebrities are packaged very carefully. There are assumptions about what a politician or what a movie star says or how they live, and so on. Of course, that gets chipped away at almost from the beginning. There are rebels and iconoclasts in Hollywood and in Washington, still, and eventually all of those restrictions come tumbling down around the 1960s. But they're in place during the Golden Age pretty strongly.
Right. And I suppose it helps explain why this alliance became so strong, because if, in fact, Hollywood had been kind of a more turbulent, unpredictable world, then it would have been kind of a dangerous thing with which to align yourself as a politician. But if, in effect, the world sees the world of film and sees Hollywood as a place where the good guys win and there is sort of a moral order at play, I mean, for all the fun that films could create, I mean, it still seemed like a well-ordered universe. And it's exactly the kind of universe to which a politician like the U.S. president would want to attach themselves.
Right, right. And, of course, the real universe, the real world, is in turmoil in the 1930s, 40s, 50s. There's constant change, constant danger, terrible things happening. It's very artificial, certainly, but it's in some ways, because of this turmoil, the need to construct an understandable present is even more important. So, you know, the government as well as the people rely on Hollywood to sell the war, to define World War II, the war effort after Pearl Harbor. You know, certainly they're aware of the realities, but it's very tempting to kind of put it in a box and see it as this very convenient good versus evil movie playing out.
You, of course, are talking now about an era in which the movies are becoming huge. And I think a lot of us can very easily understand how a breezy, confident figure like Franklin D. Roosevelt would feel very comfortable in that world and hobnobbing with such stars. And it's a little harder to get our heads around the notion of someone like the taciturn Herbert Hoover, Roosevelt's predecessor, having strong ties to Hollywood. And in fact, he does. In fact, you tell us that President Hoover's interactions with the motion picture industry signaled a new alignment of the movies with the presidency.
Yeah.
What was at the heart of that alignment?
Well, Hoover was a fascinating figure who I can't say too much about, but in the 1920s, before he becomes president, he serves 8 years as Secretary of Commerce. And he is a very active commerce secretary. He researches what's happening in the American economy, which is booming in the 20s. And he's fascinated by all of the new industries that are emerging, including motion pictures. And he's also, by the way, quite tuned into the fact that Americans are spending much more money and time on leisure. They have the free time. They have the disposable income for that. And so he makes contacts as Commerce Secretary with the movie studio heads, and he's very close to Louis B. Mayer, the head of MGM, and they maintain a close relationship after Hoover becomes president. And Hoover is also the first president to appear in newsreels regularly. He's not much of a performer at all. He's also the first president to get critical mail from citizens saying that he ought to lighten up or change his speaking style in front of the camera, which becomes a constant. People critiquing the on-camera demeanor and speech-making of presidents. And he's also establishing the Republican Party's roots in the film industry for fundraising, for support. A lot of Republican film executives become involved, especially in the California Republican Party. And then FDR does the same for the Democrats. He establishes a very strong Democratic base among producers, actors, others in Hollywood for fundraising, but also just for campaign support.
You tell us that during the time of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, that connection was even deepened. You quote someone as saying, "It was Franklin Roosevelt who first perceived the power of association waiting to be harnessed in Hollywood stars." And one of the things you tell us is that during Roosevelt's presidency, kind of what you call an unwritten but long-standing American taboo began to be broached, that involving film stars speaking out in politically partisan fashion.
Yes, that's right, absolutely. very strong liberal contingent. They start being called liberals in the 30s, you know, in support of the New Deal. People like Melvin Douglas, Helen Hagen Douglas, his wife, who later became a congressman, Orson Welles, a little later on, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall, all, you know, would go out and campaign for FDR when he was running, especially in the 40s, for his third or especially his fourth term was really a big occasion where a lot of movie stars went out and campaigned for him. So, yes, that was definitely a factor then. The other thing about Roosevelt, which is kind of in a different area of American culture, but I think significant, is that he was an actor. in a very profound sense. He hid his disability, his paralysis from polio, constantly. When he was in public, every second he was acting, pretending that he could walk. And it was an incredibly strenuous physical performance that he put on. And so he understood, you know, in his gut, how much performance was at the center of being a president. And in some cases, I think with John F. Kennedy as well, we see this performance of acting like you're healthy and a whole man as part of the modern presidency. Hmm.
The president who is pictured on the cover of your book is Roosevelt's successor, Harry S. Truman. And, of course, this is another figure, I suppose, in a little bit like Herbert Hoover. I mean, a short, bespeckled, studious man without any of the sort of fancy, frilly trappings that one associates yeah. with the world of Hollywood and stardom. And mm-hmm. yet there is a very important connection there and sense of kind of comfortable ease. In a sense, Truman picks right up where Roosevelt left off, amazingly.
Well, the photograph is actually when Truman was vice president, appearing at the National Press Club in February 1945. He'd just become vice president. It was 2 months before he became president when FDR died. And it was an appearance by the Hollywood Canteen, which was a group of actors raising money for the canteens, which were places where servicemen could come and have some R&R. I think there was one in New York and one in Los Angeles. And one of the stars was a brand-new star, 20-year-old Lauren Bacall, who had actually been at the Manhattan Canteen before she was noticed by a screen tester. She had starred in To Have and Have Not. This was probably her first publicity event as a star. Vice President Truman walks in. There's an upright piano. Truman plays the piano. Someone suggests that Lauren Bacall drape herself on top of the upright with Vice President Truman playing away, and it makes for a wonderful photograph with this beautiful film star sort of floating above the vice president, who seems to be enjoying himself quite a bit playing the piano. Now, as you say, it is somewhat out of character for Truman, who was a plain-spoken Missourian. He really didn't have that coastal relationship to celebrity that FDR had. He was not an actor at all. He was one of those plain-spoken, small-R Republican politicians. And really, Truman does not have that much contact with the film industry during his presidency, which is ironic because it's a time of great upheaval in Hollywood. There's the controversy over alleged communists in Hollywood, leading to the blacklists and other persecutions in Hollywood. The film industry, the studios lose the movie theater chains that they own. There's an antitrust decision by the Supreme Court, which divests them of their theaters, which starts causing real turmoil in the theater's profit margins. And really, in the studio's profit margins, and really leads to the decline of the studios, which becomes drastic in the 50s and 60s. And, of course, there's turmoil in the world with the onset of the Cold War. The interesting thing about Truman is that he's the first president who has to deal with television. And television, in many ways, takes the attributes of the movies and puts it on the small screen brings it into everyone's living rooms and makes the president something of a celebrity or a star on the television. And there are all sorts of interesting manifestations or implications for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, that certainly comes true in the next decade, of course, doesn't it? During the presidency of President Eisenhower, whom you say had rehearsed the art of self-presentation for years before ever becoming president, and came to the office with a very deep savvy, with a profound know-how about how the world of motion picture and television could serve him well. But, of course, it is his vice president, Richard Nixon, in that famous Checker speech, who propels everything forward again, understanding the power of television, the power of stepping into people's homes.
Yeah. Well, Eisenhower had some background in that. As commanding general of the D-Day invasion, he took a special effort to polish his radio delivery because he did give some addresses in 1944 and 1945. He ended up filming an introduction to an Oscar-winning documentary film about the final days of World War II. He had a journalist assist him in his radio presentations and in his delivery. And also, earlier, he had served under Douglas MacArthur, who was probably the most theatrical general in the Army. Ike was fond of saying, I studied theatrics under MacArthur for 5 years in the Philippines. So Eisenhower was aware of that as a tool for being a successful politician. And when he's in the White House, he hires, well, he doesn't hire, he makes use of the services donated by Robert Montgomery, a Hollywood actor, now a TV star, who becomes his consultant on television appearances, a very controversial consultant in the 1950s. Nixon's Checkers speech, which is during the campaign in 1952, is a much less polished occasion. It's a half-hour live TV speech seen by 40 million people. It's the most watched political speech in history. And Nixon improvises virtually the whole thing. He's on the stage of a little studio in Hollywood where they filmed TV sitcoms in 1952. It's got kind of a conventional living room set. His wife, Pat, is sitting there in a chair. And Nixon is not terribly polished at all. It's a clumsy, somewhat maudlin speech that he gives, but it is a huge hit, simply the fact that he is on television. Of course, wins him a lot of support, but also the lack of polish earns him a lot of derision, mostly from Democrats who label Nixon as this panderer who will say or do anything to get votes.
And, of course, from there, there's all kinds of other stories which we will be leaving to our listeners to explore. The vivid charisma of John F. Kennedy, of course, in his very, very short presidency, of course, the intriguing stories of LBJ and Nixon, of Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, of course, that iconic figure of Ronald Reagan, a man of Hollywood, literally, who, of course, brings those gifts to bear in fascinating fashion, and, of course, the successors after that, and this fascinating relationship continues to this very day, all explored in this incredibly interesting book called The Leading Man, Hollywood and the Presidential Image. The book is published by Rutgers University Press and includes some very, very interesting photographs as well, on top of the very fine writing of Burton Peretti. Professor Peretti, I very much enjoyed this this book and this opportunity to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it very much, too. Thank you.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Easter candy, and of course, don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's at 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Carthage College's Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. 45 degrees, we're seeing in Kenosha, 44 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, heading for an afternoon high of 53. We'll join Wisconsin Public Radio's classical music programming here at 9 o'clock. This is WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.